This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of October. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Vernier. Here's what we got for you this week. The gender gap at the Austin City Limits Music Festival.
I feel like the headliners are always older guy bands. Pearl Jam, Foo Fighters, Tom Petty.
The impact of economic impact studies.
Economic impact studies are, unfortunately, for the most part, not a search for truth. They're primarily commissioned to legitimize a position.
And the history of the Jews in Texas.
The Jewish community here has quintupled in the last 30 years.
Those stories and a lot more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, I'd like to invite you to subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. There you will find links to iTunes, Stitcher, RSS, SoundCloud. If you have any questions, you can ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUTNathan, or if you like, you can email me, nathan@kut.org. KUT Weekend is not the only podcast by your local NPR station. We produce several, and KUT's own Rebecca McEnroy is here to tell me about one that you might want to check out. How's it going, Rebecca?
Hey, Nathan. Thanks for having me.
So you do a few podcasts for us, but there's one that you wanted to highlight in particular because I asked you to. So tell me about it.
Yes. The Secret Ingredient, which is a podcast we produce here at KUT with food writers Raj Patel and Tom Philpott. On this week's episode of The Secret Ingredient, we interview Marion Nessel. She's a food writer, and she recently wrote a book called Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. We talk about all kinds of crazy stuff around the marketing of soda and ideology in the United States, and what Coca-Cola is doing with milk. It might shock you. So I hope you can join us. Subscribe on iTunes to The Secret Ingredient. You can also catch us on SoundCloud.
Sounds cool. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
More people are moving to the city every minute, it seems. So if you're among those who are here before Uber and Lyft began operating, you might be able to attest to how hard it was sometimes to catch a cab at certain times of day or in certain parts of town. But paying someone to drive you somewhere has become a lot easier with the ride-on-demand companies Uber and Lyft setting up shop in Austin. Only thing is, the cab companies say it's not fair. They have to pay licensing fees. They have to follow tougher regulations than Uber and Lyft. So the Austin City Council is moving even closer now to trying to make the playing field more even. That could mean charging ride-sharing companies more money to operate, something Uber and Lyft aren't too happy about. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reports on the developments this week.
If the full city council approves it, Uber and Lyft will get to decide how much they'll pay. Option number one, pay a $450 permit fee per driver, which taxi companies pay the city now. Option number two, pay 1% of the company's annual revenue in Austin. These two options are what the council's mobility committee approved. It's not that Uber and Lyft are unwilling.
We have no problem paying a fee.
Are you willing to pay a fee, basically?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That was April Mims from Lyft and Adam Blinnick with Uber. But company representatives at the meeting said they don't understand the need for fees. And in the case of paying what taxi cab drivers pay for permits now, it's too much.
If every driver is required to pay $450, even if they never drive for Lyft, or they take one ride and they never drive again, we basically don't have a business model.
April Mims with Lyft says because many of their drivers work less than 15 hours a week, such a high fee doesn't make sense. If the rules are approved, the companies will get the choice and may opt to pay 1% of their revenue. The ordinance now heads to the full council for approval. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
Well, this week, some people in Austin got really freaked out because someone on the website 4chan made a post just like the one allegedly made by that guy in Oregon who walked into a community college and killed 9 people. Fortunately, the threat turned out to be fake, but University of Texas police and the Austin Police Department worked with other law enforcement agencies to investigate. They had to check it out. They even worked with the federal law enforcement. KUT's Ben Philpott reports that local officials are taking all of these threats seriously, even though so far they say none of them has been credible.
The threat posted on the website 4chan and then passed around on social media Monday read, "Some of you guys are all right. Don't go to school tomorrow if you're near Austin." UT Police Department Chief David Carter says, just like with any threat, the first step was figuring out how credible it is.
So as we looked into the actual posting, per se, is that
what we see is that, number one, it's sort of implied, and it's very vague, and it's not specific to UT. So there is nothing that suggests that UT is a specific target.
Cities across the country were the subject of a similar message. APD Intelligence Division Commander Joseph Chacon says law enforcement is watching to find these web-posted threats. But he also wants people who see a threatening post to report it.
If they're able to preserve it with a screenshot, if they're looking on their mobile device or if they're on their computer, great. I would say do that and then call 911 and let them know what you've got, and we will begin that investigative process.
So far, the investigations across the country have already resulted in the arrest of one suspect in Arkansas. And Chacon again wants to stress the threats have been deemed not credible.
Having said that, could there be a lone wolf actor out there who has bad intent? I think that's a possibility.
Chacon did add his own children were in school this week. Ben Philpott, KUT News.
Turns out it is legal to burn the flag, the U.S. or the Texas flag. That's what the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals ruled this week, striking down a state law that banned desecrating the flags. KUT's Matt Largy was watching.
The U.S. Supreme Court struck down the Texas ban on flag desecration in 1989, along with similar laws in almost every other state. But the Texas legislature passed a new, slightly different version of the law a short time later. Now, the state's highest criminal court says that law, too, is an infringement on First Amendment rights. The case involved a man named Terrence Johnson, who was arrested for tearing a U.S. flag out of a store window and throwing it into the street. He told police he was angry with a store employee, claiming the person had made racial comments about his mother. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals concluded Johnson's actions were protected under the First Amendment and that the state law he was charged under must be struck down. Matt Largy, KUT News.
The second weekend of Austin City Limits starts today. Recording this on a Friday, of course, and there are some differences from last week. Florence and the Machine is headlining Sunday night instead of the Strokes. And Modest Mouse is playing instead of Alabama Shakes. Now, if you look at the lineup overall, Florence Welch and Brittany Howard, the lead singer of Alabama Shakes, they're the only female performers in the top 10 performing slots. This lack of female representation happens a lot at music festivals across the country, and KUT's Kate McGee wanted to know why.
Here are the 10 largest acts performing this weekend at ACL.
Foo Fighters.
Drake.
Florence and the Machine.
The Weeknd.
Disclosure.
Bass Nectar.
Alt-J.
Hozier.
Of Monsters and Men.
Nearly all of those groups are made up of male performers. Two have female vocalists, but the rest of the musicians are male. Outside Austin city limits last week, Austinite Laura Presley says she's not surprised by the male-heavy lineup.
I feel like the headliners are always older guy bands. Pearl Jam, Foo Fighters, Tom Petty, Willie Nelson.
Florence and the Machine, she's going to be here this weekend. But she's like the only big chick.
That's Catherine Hale, Presley's friend.
I don't like many female vocalists, so I prefer the male band. Yeah. But I'm excited about Alabama Shakes.
Yeah.
She's got like a manly voice.
That's another friend, Bonnie Ising. Presley jumps back in.
I think it's just the same, like, as everywhere else in the workplace and, you know, bosses, everything. There's always a gender disparity between that.
It definitely exists on the stages at ACL. Looking back at ACL lineups over the past 5 years, the number of female performers listed in the top 10 spots is slim to none. Last year, Lana Del Rey held down the fort among a lineup that included Eminem, Pearl Jam, and Outkast. The year before that, not a single female performer was listed in the top 10 slots. Before that, in 2012, Florence and the Machine was once again the only female headliner. And in 2011, Alison Krauss and Union Station.
Since the late 1960s, women musicians have definitely been marginalized and discouraged within this particular arena.
That's Mary Celeste Kearney, a professor at Notre Dame who studies gender and music, especially rock and roll. It's unclear how C3, the company who puts on ACL, chooses its big acts. They did not respond to multiple interview requests. But Kearney says the gender disparity in music starts early. She says parents and adults socialize young girls to not get involved in aggressive genres like rock and roll.
In really basic ways, girls from a really young age are just excluded from the culture. It's one that happens typically at night, typically in not great places in town, you know, so parents have been discouraging of their daughters from getting involved in this.
That socialization can begin early in school.
They join a school band. Where do the women sit? Where do the guys sit? What kind of instruments are they allowed to play with and experiment with? All of that plays into how kids are feeling comfortable with certain genres of music.
Even all female bands like this one, the sister trio Haim, who played at ACL a few years ago, can run into their own problems. Kearney says sometimes those bands are booked simply because female musicians are seen as unique.
If you're getting ahead only because you're a gender, then that means that your musicianship is always secondhand. That is, you know, the number one thing I've learned from studying this particular culture. Women musicians are always seen as women first and musicians second.
If you look at the lineup of both weekends together, Florence and the Machine is the only female vocalist in the top 10. The next bands to include women are Alabama Shakes and Of Monsters and Men. They have female vocalists, but the rest of the band's musicians are nearly all male. Kearney says that structure is common.
If you look at the women who are fronting all male bands, they are typically more attractive or more conventionally attractive. And so that's seen as kind of a safe place for both them, because they get to affirm their femininity, and for the guys in the band, because they're not challenging much of anything in terms of gender politics. You know, the guys still get to be in charge of the music and play, you know, the instruments and et cetera.
You could argue Howard of Alabama Shakes challenges this critique as a strong woman with a commanding stage presence. Your line, don't cross them lines. Plus, she also plays guitar. But Howard is the exception, not the rule. Kearney says all of these issues mean there are fewer female performers to choose from when booking small bands or large festivals like ACL. For those looking to see some female performers this weekend, you might want to head to the smaller stages. Kate McGee, KUT News.
If you don't go to ACL and you don't want anything to do with it, you might just think of the two-weekend event as a headache that takes up a lot of attention and makes traffic worse. But the thousands of people who come here for ACL, and even those who live here and go to ACL, they tend to spend a lot of money, and that puts some money in the pockets of people who live here. Now, C3 Presents, which puts on ACL, said last year ACL had a $194 million economic impact. And C3 says ACL has had a nearly $1 billion economic impact since 2006. As KUT's Jimmy Moss reports, the exact number of how much money Austin City Limits is generating is actually kind of hard to pin down.
Often when you hear about festivals and big events around town, you hear about their economic impact for the city. We're not talking about ticket sales. We're talking about what happens before, during, and just after.
Well, if you're talking about these special events, I think you can summarize it best by saying that it's all about the spending and who is doing the spending.
Terry Clower is director of public policy at George Mason University. For years, Dr. Clower was director of the Center for Economic Development and Research at the University of North Texas.
Typically, when you're doing these analyses, it's drawing the line of what is local versus non-local. You know, who is coming from outside the area that we want to count.
The reports tout how much an event, a company, or sports entity might mean to the local economy. But these reports aren't always generated out of goodwill, according to Professor John Crompton at Texas A&M University.
Economic impact studies are, unfortunately, for the most part, not a search for truth. My experience has been they're primarily commissioned to legitimize a position.
He says usually that position involves the use of taxpayer dollars. Does the civic investment make the payoff worth it? Economic impact reports are their own small industry. Economists are paid to perform market studies and research to determine a bottom line figure that we, as a public, can get our head around. It makes something like subsidizing a Formula One race or giving tax incentives to a big employer more palatable politically. It seems everyone is doing it. If you Google economic impact reports, you get Google's economic impact report on each state. It says Google helps generate $6.64 billion in economic activity around the state of Texas. Circuit of the Americas commissions one regularly to prove its worth. Just last month, South by Southwest and the University of Texas Athletics Department reported their respective impacts on the Austin economy. Hugh Forrest, CEO of South by Southwest Interactive, made the big announcement last month outside City Hall.
At $317.2 million, the economic impact for South by Southwest is about two-thirds the economic impact of a Super Bowl. I think that's a great way for a lot of us to better understand and visualize the magnitude of this event. In many, many ways, South by Southwest is the big game for Austin.
Mayor Steve Adler crowed over specific benefits to Austin's tax receipts.
In March of this year alone, the hotel occupancy tax fund was 70% more than in the average month.
But if South by Southwest is Austin's big game, what about the guys that actually put on big games? The University of Texas Athletic Department published a glossy report saying it is a force to be reckoned with as far as events go in Austin. The report says UT generates more than $700 million in output a year. A closer look at the report, it includes numbers that may be a stretch in reality, like when it comes to tailgating. It says spending on food and supplies totals more than $33 million. In order for that to be correct, every man, woman, and child that attends UT home games would have to spend an additional $55 per person on brats and folding chairs before each and every game. That would be on top of a ticket price and snacks and souvenirs inside, which are also added into the bottom line. Closely held HEB has the largest market share of Austin grocers. A spokesperson wouldn't give me exact figures, but says tailgating isn't among the top 10 events the stores plan for annually. Not to say there isn't a tremendous economic boon from Texas athletics, but UT's study came out as then-athletic director Steve Patterson was pushing the city for a new arena to replace the aging Irwin Center. Once again, Dr. John Crompton.
You follow the money and you see who commissioned it, and for the most part you're going to find that the person who commissioned it got the findings that they want.
Angelos Angelou, the guy who did the study for UT and others, did not respond to an interview request. So, is there any way to get to the bottom of an event's value to Austin?
Those of us who have been involved in this for many years have a rule of thumb, and it generally is if you move the decimal point on the number at the end one place to the left, most of the time you get it about right. That's a cynical point of view, but in fact, it actually isn't far out when you come to look at many of these studies. So instead of people saying it's $100 million, it generally ends up at $10 million.
While we may never get a true grasp of their dollar value, there is little doubt ACL, South by Southwest, Texas Athletics, and others bring money, visitors, and status to Austin. And if you think money is hard to keep track of, status is an even more elusive thing to measure, at least until someone commissions a status impact study.
New federal rules to limit smog, also known as ozone pollution, were big news last week. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, they say the rules will save lives, they'll protect public health. Industry says the rules are bad for business. But these smog rules, these ozone rules, have come under fire for another reason. Some people who want smog reduced say the government's doing it the wrong way. So for State Impact Texas, KUT's Mose Bushell begrudgingly reports on the complicated system we use to reduce ozone pollution.
I hate reporting on these rules. They combine everything that does not work on radio. A lot of numbers, technical jargon, averages. Ugh, yuck. But here's why this is important. The way we measure ozone determines how much of it we breathe. And you don't want to breathe it. Ozone causes asthma, could contribute to low birth weights.
And of course, the worst harm is it's been found to cause premature death.
Janice Nolan works on policy for the American Lung Association.
And that puts it in a class of pollutants that we really, really have to bring down.
So, all over the country, air monitors keep tabs on ozone levels. Just last week, the EPA set the acceptable maximum level at 70 parts per billion. But a region is allowed to break that limit sometimes, says Dan Cohan. He's a professor of environmental engineering at Rice University.
The standard is set based on the fourth worst pollution day
of each year and actually at the worst monitor in each city.
And here's where things get confusing.
And it's not even just within 1 year, but over a period of 3 years.
Wait, don't change the station. We can do this. I can do this. Here it is again. The federal standard takes the fourth worst ozone day near you each year and averages it over 3 years. So, to put it another way, look at the number in your town. In Austin, it's about 68. That means, on average, there are 3 days out of the year that are worse.
You're very right on that.
Okay, moving on.
Let me explain why we set the system up the way we do. This system, complicated as it is, eliminates areas from being targeted where there's just a day or two that has a problem.
So if there's a wildfire or some kind of accident that pushes a monitor over the limit, your town can still be in compliance with federal law. But there are drawbacks to the system.
In environmental management, we have a phrase that what gets measured gets done.
Again, Rice's Dan Cohan.
And since we're measuring and regulating ozone and focusing on these four worst days, regulators are focusing on the best strategies for reducing ozone on those peak days.
Anything under that 70 parts per billion peak kind of gets a pass. That means you could be breathing a lot of ozone a lot of the time, even in areas that are meeting federal standards, or you could live in a city technically over the limit, but on pretty much every other day, the air is fine.
We really need to be concerned about measures that might be having some unintended consequences.
Cohan says that's a reason to rethink the whole way we measure ozone. Janice Nolan says the EPA should look into that, but what the Lung Association really wants is a stricter limit to around 60 parts per billion. One thing they agree on, at least the new standard provides a concrete goal for polluted parts of the country, even if it is a little tricky to explain. Reporting on energy and the environment for State Impact Texas, I'm Mose Bouchel, KET News.
Jews celebrated the start of Simchat Torah this week. The holiday marks the end of the annual cycle of Torah readings and starts off the new cycle. Jews in Austin just recently got two historic Torah trolls to read from. These scrolls, along with a 19th century synagogue like The Building, they came from a disappearing Jewish community in Brenham. KUT's Veronica Saragovia has more on the history of Judaism in Texas.
Since they arrived in Texas back in the 19th century, Brian Stone says Jews wanted to fit in. Stone teaches history at Del Mar College in Corpus Christi.
They accommodated to some extent to the culture of the place they came to. And if that means boots and hats, you know, and a drawl, they'll pick that up.
I recently told Stone that as a Jew from Miami, I'm used to yarmulkes and flip-flops. But when I recently saw Jews in cowboy hats, I thought, oy vey. We're standing outside of Austin's newest synagogue. It's actually more than 120 years old. It came from Brenham, moved here in three pieces on the back of a truck. They rebuilt it on Austin's Dell Jewish Community Campus, where a ribbon-cutting ceremony took place in August.
Ask them to cut the ribbon, and once they're inside and have a moment to put the Torahs into the ark, we'll begin our Torah. Woo!
Leon Tobin is in the crowd. He's 87 and remembers what it was like to pray in here as a kid.
When I went in by myself and I sat down and I looked around and I remember where my father sat, where my grandfather sat, where the rabbi sat, and the different members that were relations of mine. It was special.
Back in Brenham, he and his wife were its only remaining caretakers. The rest of the congregants moved away or died off. The Tobins made a painful decision to move the white wooden synagogue out of Brenham to a place where it could thrive again.
This celebration of a new birth of Judaism here is touch. It's something I'd never dreamed of. I thank God that it happened.
It's certainly unusual. Synagogues rarely get saved for their original purpose when the congregants are gone, says Brian Stone. He wrote the book, The Chosen Folks, Jews on the Frontiers of Texas. Stone says Brenham isn't the only historically Jewish community to decline and eventually disappear.
We could mourn the loss of small Jewish communities, but then that's a lot to mourn because there's a lot of them and there are very few left, not just in Texas, but all over the country.
Towns across Texas got most of their Jewish residents when they moved here in the 1800s. Most came from cities like New York, New Orleans, and Charleston. From 1907 to 1914, a wave of Jews came directly from Europe through Galveston. Hollis Ava Weiner is a Texas Jewish historian based in Fort Worth. She says Jews quickly adjusted to life in Texas.
We have in Tyler, there was a rabbi named Solomon Greenberg, and he saw that his neighbors were smoking hams, so he smoked kosher turkeys.
He started in the late 1930s. Today, the business he started, Greenberg Smoked Turkeys, still exists in Tyler. Another example is in Marshall, Texas. Jews used to have a synagogue there, built in 1900. Its sisterhood raised money to build an annex in 1939 by selling Mabel Stein's hot tamales.
Instead of, let's say, something Jewish.
Corsicana still has a synagogue from the 1890s that has twin onion domes. It's on the National Register of Historic Places, but it's now a public space for everybody.
When people visit Corsicana, they know, without even reading about it, that once this was a center of a strong Jewish community.
Meantime, back in Austin, the Jewish community here has quintupled in the last 30 years. Brenham's loss is Austin's gain. Orthodox Jews here now have a synagogue to use, the one moved here from Brenham. This month, the building will see its first wedding in more than 75 years. Veronica Saragovia, KUT News.
Dallas today, thousands of Longhorns and Sooners are all streaming into town for Texas OU weekend. The Red River Showdown kicks off tomorrow morning at 11. Now, if you cannot afford a ticket to the Cotton Bowl, clever folks at the State Fair of Texas can still have a lot of fun on the cheap. From Dallas Public Radio, Courtney Collins has the Insider's Guide.
There are few places on this earth that serve fried butter, showcase high-jumping border collies, and feature a kid show narrated by a talking buzzard.
Oh, and I see a whole family down here. Howdy-do!
Tomorrow, add in crazed football fans from the universities of Texas and Oklahoma in town for their annual grudge match. Sooner Megan McClellan says there's nothing like it.
It's crazy, it's hectic, but it's so much fun just to come out here and hang out with fans of both teams.
Crazy, hectic, and potentially expensive. Tickets to the game cost more than $100. For those who just want to tailgate and roam the fair, you still have to pay $15 to park. Adult admission, $18.
Thank you.
To save on parking, you can take DART. And once you're inside the gates, there's a shocking amount of free, starting with the concerts and shows. So if you're looking for a few good vibrations Sunday night, the Beach Boys are free. Same goes for the all-new Mattress Firm Illumination Sensation. For the little ones, the kids' boardwalk doesn't cost a thing. It has sandboxes, giant chessboards, face painting, temporary tattoos, and crafts.
Whoa!
Is it yellow also?
The charge for the fair's famous car show? Zip. The Big Texas Music Exhibit? Nada. Canstruction, a dramatic display of architecturally arranged canned goods, is built on a foundation of free. Fair food's a little trickier. There are some sneaky ways to snack on the cheap. Step one, stay away from the fried stuff. The name of the game is samples.
These are spicy chicken pickles we made with 17 herbs and 17 spices.
At the Food and Fiber Pavilion, you can get a lot more than pickles. A lap around the place yields apples, chips and salsa, candied almonds, and a full-size vanilla ice cream cone. Mitch Williams worked at the State Fair for 23 years and used to rely on this place for a midday pick-me-up.
Back in the 70s and 80s, when I used to work here, you could run through here and fill up on samples. You could actually make a lot.
If you're free to fair go during the week, you can save a lot of cash at the gate. Seniors get in free every Thursday. On Wednesdays, all it takes is 4 cans of food and $4. So while Texas OU weekend is State Fair prime time, folks on a tighter budget should wait until next week.
Welcome to the State Fair of Texas.
Remember, Big Tex himself doesn't care if you spend $200 or $10.
Courtney Collins with Dallas Public Radio Station KERA, reporting from the State Fair of Texas.
I was born in Louisiana, down on the Ohio. Raised on shrimps and catfish, Mammy's good gumbo. I got the rambling fever, said goodbye to Ma and Pa. Cross that old Red River, this is what I saw. I saw miles and miles of Texas, all the stars up in the sky. I saw miles and miles of Texas, gonna live here till I die.
That, my friends, is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of October. Remember, you can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. If you listen in iTunes, please feel free to leave us a review. It does help. If you have any questions or comments, let me know on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. You can email me, nathan@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. And then,